Well, of course, it's very tempting to say, since I am on the glide path to retirement and stepping away, I can finally come out and favor a sin. I wish that were the sermon today, but it really isn't. There's a famous story that I know I've told at least once, but it's a famous story about Calvin Coolidge, who was famously silent, taciturn, and gave one-word responses. If they had had radio, it would have been a nightmare to interview him. And he came back from church one day, and his wife said, "Well, what happened at church?" "Service." "Well, what did the minister do?" "Sermon." "Well, what was the sermon about?" "Sin." "Well, what did he say?" "He was against it." So it's, of course, tempting to come out in favor of the seven deadly sins in particular, but there are problems involved in just the concept of sin, never mind deadly. What is a sin? And we don't really agree on it, and I can tell you that Unitarian Universalists are very uncomfortable with sin. Not the actual acts, but the idea that there could be something that is a sin. We tend to go for those secular sins like drinking Coors beer and eating non-union grapes. We have a whole kind of set of sins that are things that don't correspond to our actions, that don't correspond to our values. But the idea that there could be some kinds of universal and cosmic sins is upsetting. And lots of different religions have taken different kinds of positions on this, and they seem to break down into a couple of areas and criticisms when discussing, when discussing sins. And that is, we have a psychological approach to it, which is, well, do people really transgress knowingly, or is it a psychological defect? Do we do bad things just because we're not made psychologically sound, that we've been influenced by heredity and environment, and we have impulses and compulsions that we really aren't completely responsible for? And there's the philosophical view, the Socratic view, if you will, where Socrates said people would do good if we only knew what the good was. So when there is sin, when there is transgression, it's because we don't really understand what's good for us. And if we properly understood, we wouldn't do those things. I have to say that's not been my experience, but who am I to argue with Socrates? And who's Socrates to try to argue back across the ages? Then there's the theological one, the one that makes Unitarians uncomfortable, the idea that there could be something that universal and transcendent in terms of codes of behavior. And at that point, we start to get into the product defect defense, which is, well, if God made me and I'm sinful, God just should have done a better job. I mean, God knew I was going to sin and God could have prevented it. And why did God choose to make me a sinner? These are some of the issues that come up in Calvinism and other predeterministic religions, to some extent in Islam, and to some extent in every Orthodox religion. There's always that defect question, which is, why do we have the different impulses that we have, and how are we to understand them? Different religions seem to take different approaches, but I find an awful lot that they have in common. When we start with, as I was terrified you were going to go completely through the entire sermon, with the Ten Commandments referenced somewhere behind that screen. The Ten Commandments are actually not Ten Commandments, and no, I'm not saying they're just the Ten Suggestions. They are, in fact, the seven prohibitions. Seven of them start with don't, Whatever you were thinking, just don't. Don't steal. Don't lie. Don't commit adultery. All kinds of don'ts out there, and they in some ways correspond to those seven deadly sins, also and importantly known as the seven cardinal sins. And I'll get back to why the term cardinal is really important in terms of my discussion today. So we look at the seven deadly sins, and they have something in common. And I'm going to get them wrong, so I'm probably going to have to look at my notes, because I'm fairly good at committing them, but it's harder to memorize them for some reason. But when you start out with gluttony, and then you go on to anger, and I'm just going to read them and not take your time up with this, and lust, oh, how could I have forgotten that one, greed, you know, I never got around to memorizing this, sloth, and envy and pride, what they have in common is that they're isolating behaviors. They keep us away from each other. Lust. Lust is the consuming of another person. It's the using of another person. It's not intimacy. It's consumption. It's treating a person as an object and a thing, and that ultimately keeps us away from not only that object, but it keeps us away from a loving mutual relationship. When we look at gluttony, that's another one that keeps us away to some extent from ourselves and to some extent from others. It is, again, ravenous, taking in, building up a wall that keeps us away, trying to sate senses and fill needs with something that can't fill the deeper needs, and it too is isolating. When you are with somebody who is gluttonous on a compulsive kind of way, it's pretty unpleasant. Greed. Well, greed, that's the avaricious part, is trying to gather all of this stuff together to me, to give me some sense of status, something that I have not earned through building, but through wanting, through needing, and through needing what you have as much as my getting it. It's almost as good to deny it to you. Sloth. There are a lot of theologians, not to mention professional mental health people, who think that sloth is the very worst of all of the deadly sins, all of the cardinal sins, because it really is akin to depression. It is the kind of lethargy that keeps us out of life, that keeps us from being involved in what is the responsibility of human beings to act, to live, to love, to reach out, to share, to do something to fix this broken world, to repair the wounds of the world, the wounds of spirit, and the physical wounds we do to the earth and we do to each other. And sloth is a giving up on life, giving up on a sense that our lives have meaning, that our efforts can do something, that it's worthwhile to get up in the morning and to wash up and to go out there and meet the day, because why bother? We're just going to get dirty again, and the world is not going to be healed, and our efforts aren't worth anything, so I'm just going to stay and do nothing. Keeps us away from the world, from each other, and ultimately from ourselves. Wrath. Wrath is kind of unpleasant to be with on an extended period of time. When you're with people who are angry and wrathful, and there's a sense of if not physical violence, emotional violence. And that's often not constructive. And people who are wrathful and filled with rage and anger find it easier to tear down than to build up, than to engage, than to invite and involve others into the real work of living together, of being in society, in community, in family together. Envy. Envy is another one of those things that it's almost as important to prevent you from having something than I actually acquiring it. I am envy of your status, of your possessions, because I think if I will get those things, it will make me more important, which leads us to pride, to arrogance, to the condescension that comes from people who are prideful, and the old word that gets used in the seven deadly sins is often vainglorious, which is the sense of vanity, of person, but also that it is in vain that we try to lord ourselves above others and seek status in diminishing the other person. That's the kind of pride that the seven cardinal sins are talking about. And yet, as Thomas said in the opening words, scaring me half unto death, is that, boy, they don't sound so bad, because we all recognize that these have good aspects to them, which is the part that I'm about to defend. And the key word, the classic word that got used, was cardinal sins. And when we think of cardinals, other than for birds and baseball players, we think of the color red. And so those are red sins. The actual word goes back to an origin that is hinge, as in a door hinge. And I think that's the clue about these particular sins. They are sins in terms of how much that door is open or how much that door is closed. There are obviously good sides to each of these cardinal sins, that whether you're talking about lust, well, desire is perfectly nice. Eroticism is lovely. The sin is not in terms of the desires that we feel, but the connection of to a human being, that we are in a mutual relationship that is fruitful and affirms both, as opposed to the consuming or simply the using of the other. So at this point, that large gate is lust. And at this point, there is a place where it is eros and desire and connection and intimacy. It depends on how far open or closed the door is to the other. The same is true of gluttony. There is appetite. The opposite of gluttony is not an air fast until you die. The opposite is a sense of appetite and appreciation and consciousness and sharing. It's not at all accidental that all of our major religions emphasize the sharing of communal meals, a sense of communion, whether you theologize it as a Eucharist or simply as an ethnic breads or a family meal. When we share down and enjoy food together, we are enjoying the stuff of life. That is not a sin. The mindless consumption is the sin. But the enjoyment and the consciousness is the virtue. Greed. Well, not a lot I can say. Greed is good. That was an aphorism whose death we do not mourn. But the idea of having some ambition, of having something that wants us to be more, to achieve more, to be able to have, to share more, that's the other side of greed. The other side of greed is not a hair shirt. I actually was with somebody who's a multimillionaire, and he said, you know, I wish I had more money. And I said, so, come on, what are you talking about? He said, you know, I give away a half a million, $750,000 a year to various medical charities. I wish I could give more. I wish I could endow a medical school. I wish I could give what Bill Gates gives. So that's not greed. That is wanting something in order to do something. Sloth. Well, I don't want to be a sloth, but I want to relax from time to time. And so the opposite of sloth is not hyperactivity. The other side of sloth, as you turn on that hinge, is knowing when to rest, knowing when to put it down, knowing when it's time to go inside and maybe meditate a little, think, be intentional about choosing how we are in the world. And so again, that door, is it sloth or versus hyperactivity, or is that door someplace where we find a moving balance of how to be in the world? Wrath. Pete Seeger is a wonderful example. He was offended at injustice. The opposite of wrath is not passivity or quietism. It is looking at the flaws, at the defects, at all of the problems of the world, and getting your dander up a little bit, but not being consumed in the adrenaline, the epinephrine of rage, but taking that sense of being offended and using it, turning it to something constructive. There's a poet who said that we should beat our swords into plowshares and keep beating on them until we have made them into instruments of music. I think that that's where you go on the other side of anger and rage, to engagement and to singing our songs and living our values in a way that does not passively just accept the realities that are offensive and that can be anger producing, but then channeling that sense of upset and of insult into something that is reparative, something that lights candles and not forest fires, something that is a song that we can sing that can bring down the walls of Jericho, as so much of the music of the civil rights movement was absolutely necessary in terms of tearing down the walls. I played for you some months ago a Joe and Eddie song of Tear Down the Walls, and the power of music, of protest music, has been enormous. It adds a dimension to rhetorical argument and the experience of being together. So being angry and offended by the injustices of the world is not a sin. To be consumed with a rage that lets you roll over people who are different instead of trying to engage in change, that's where the door swings. And envy. There are things that I want. I don't confuse them with things that are necessarily important. Those things that I tend to envy in other people, I use as something to try to make me better. I remember when I was in seminary, there was a professor who was fast, was quick, was verbal, and I knew that I had nothing to learn from him. The guy that I envied was Ron, who used to sit in his office with his feet up on the desk, and he was kind of the Jimmy Stewart. He'd just sit there and kind of go, well, yeah, interesting, yeah. He was somebody with patience, somebody who could listen, someone who was engaged. And that is what I envied. I didn't want to take it away from him, but I wanted it. I wanted to learn from it. And those have always been the things that I've envied, not to the destruction of the other. I envy people who can sing, but I don't want to stop them. I want to join them. And if they can sing, they probably don't want me to join them, but that's okay. That's okay. I do understand that. So the issue of envy is not, it's not a question of, envy is when you want to take it away from the other person, as opposed to have it shared with you, to be touched by it, to learn by it, to be inspired by it. That's why I have always sought teachers who were different from me, who could give me something that I didn't think I already had. And finally, there's pride. That's the most obvious one of all that is ambivalent. You don't want to have a life without pride. You don't want to not have pride in your children, pride in your community, pride in yourself. But you don't want that pride to be such that you look down at other families, at other children, at other communities, and saying, I am so much better. Pride is a sense of self, of self-worth. And at that point, that's the door that is open. When it's pride that is arrogant and condescending, that's when that door is closed, and we close that door on others, and we close that door on ourselves. So what is fascinating to me is that all of these sins are sins, when taken to the extreme, that lock ourselves in and lock others out of our lives. When we open the door and let each other in and let ourselves out so that we can connect, they become the seven helpful virtues. The virtues of caring about this world, of wanting a hammer to drive a nail, but maybe to tear down a wall too, but with some sense of humility, some sense of the other, some sense, some value. So for me, the key word in this defense of the seven deadly sins is we transform those sins into virtues when we examine them, and when we learn to accept the impulse and then open the door consciously to let the world into our lives and let our lives out there to touch, to change, to influence, to brighten the world with our intelligence, with our passion, with our sensitivity, with a sense of the possibilities in each of our lives to make a good difference. So yeah, I'm coming out all in favor of turning sin into virtue. We know that there are things that society generally agrees are not right. And sometimes those things are cultural. Sometimes they are time specific. Sometimes they're just complex issues that we want to debate about of what it says don't murder. Well, now, and what's murder? Murder one, murder two. We can get off on the side debates. But the essential issues are examined lives, examined values, and examining the doors that we have in our lives, and to what extent we have closed them to protect ourselves or to keep others out, and to what extent we open them up to the world to a vulnerability in which we can be hurt, but a vulnerability that also lets our values come out there and influence the world, that lets our own individual songs be sung, because that is how we change the world. We have a hymn that we do, and even some fundamentalist churches do, which is, "My life goes on in endless song." Certainly true for Pete Seeger, whatever you believe about what he can hear and can't hear, his life goes on in endless song. Our lives, too, go on in endless song. And we together choose and create the harmony, create the dissonance of those songs together. But the precondition to all of that is we sing together, sometimes strongly, sometimes weakly, often in different keys, at least to start, but we blend and create harmonies. And those harmonies are, in a sense, self-correcting. When our doors are open, when our songs are sung, we help each other stay in tune. We help each other create harmonies and vibrations that touch each other's hearts and can change, as Pete Seeger's life shows, the world.